You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 22nd of February 2012 on Monocle 24. Welcome to Midori House. We're live from Studio One at Monocle 24, and I'm Emma Barnett. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we'll be looking at PayPal's plans to create 1,000 new jobs in Ireland and the impact it will have on its unemployment figures. And we'll be checking in with the author of Economists to try and dispel common misconceptions about the economy. We'll also be joined in the studio by the creative team from the Monocle Photo Desk to hear how they put together the magazine. And we'll be continuing our look through past issues of Monocle magazine. Today, we'll be dissecting issues 21 to 30 from year 3. All that, plus some great music too, right here on Midori House on Monocle 24. And now the latest news from around the world with Nick Kelly.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Nick Kelly. A packed commuter train ploughed into the buffers at a Buenos Aires station during this morning's rush hour, killing 49 people and injuring more than 600 in Argentina's worst rail accident in more than 30 years. Passengers told of chaos and panic as the impact of the collision propelled the second train car into the first carriage, trapping dozens of people as others looked on from the busy platforms at the central Once station. Officials said 40 brakes were suspected of causing the accident. Afghan President Hamid Karzai has appealed for calm after officials said at least 6 people were shot dead and dozens wounded in protests over the burning of copies of the Quran at NATO's main base in the country. The US embassy said its staff were in lockdown and travel had been suspended as thousands of people expressed fury over the burning in protests that flared for a second day in several cities. The presidents of Russia and Iran have said that the crisis in Syria must be resolved peacefully without foreign intervention. President Medvedev and President Ahmadinejad spoke by telephone a day after the United States appeared to open the door to eventually arming Syrian rebels. President Assad's forces rained rockets and bombs down on opposition-held neighborhoods of Homs today, reducing buildings to rubble and killing more than 80 people, including 2 Western journalists. Reporter Marie Colvin and photographer Remy Ochlik died in Homs when shells hit the house they were staying in. The British Prime Minister David Cameron paid tribute to Marie Colvin in Parliament today.
This is a desperately sad reminder of the risks that journalists take to inform the world of what is happening and the dreadful events in Syria, and our thoughts should be with her family and with her friends.
The UN humanitarian chief, Valerie Amos, will head to Syria soon in an attempt to secure access for aid workers seeking to deliver emergency relief to the people trapped in the country's conflict zones. A delegation from the Syrian National Council, the SNC, the main Syrian opposition grouping, met Red Cross officials in Geneva today to discuss the agency's proposal of a daily 2-hour cessation of fighting in Syria. Senior SNC official Basma Kodmani voiced her support.
The needs have grown steadily and are growing rapidly. That we are at the threshold of something more dangerous, and we believe this option is a very interesting one.
Australia's Foreign Minister Kevin Rudd has resigned, saying he could no longer work with Prime Minister Julia Gillard and igniting a new and bitter leadership crisis for the government. Rudd told a news conference in Washington that he could not serve as Foreign Minister without the Prime Minister's support.
I can only serve as Foreign Minister if I have the confidence of Prime Minister Gillard and her senior ministers. In recent days, Minister Crean and a number of other faceless men have publicly attacked my integrity and therefore my fitness to serve.
China's leader-in-waiting Xi Jinping praised Turkey's growing role in trying to resolve hot issues such as the Iranian nuclear dispute and Middle East conflicts today, and expressed willingness to strengthen consultations with Turkish leaders on global issues. Xi was attending a business forum in Istanbul on the last leg of a trip that also took him to the United States and Ireland. Ethiopian and Somali troops captured a key Islamist militant stronghold in Somalia today as the rebels left their positions. The loss of Baidoa in central Somalia is a major blow for the Al-Qaeda-backed Al-Shabaab rebel group, which is also battling Kenyan troops to hold on to territory in southern Somalia and against African peacekeepers in pockets of the capital. Al-Shabaab said its withdrawal from the city had been tactical, aimed at avoiding casualties. And salvage workers have found 4 more bodies in the submerged Costa Concordia cruise liner, bringing the confirmed confirmed number of dead to 21 on the ship that ran aground and capsized off the Italian coast last month. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Nick. Now we're going to have a look at the Australasian newspaper headlines. Now, I've got in front of me The Press from New Zealand. Terribly, terribly moving images here as Christchurch remembers that terrible earthquake a year on. It's a civic memorial service that's going on over there today. And there's different pictures from, you know, empty seats. 185 white chairs were set out to commemorate those who lost their life in that earthquake, from people hugging and kissing each other to try and support each other while putting flowers up on railings. Very, very moving front page. And the big quote at the top is from the governor there saying, "We have seen this community endure so much."
And well, yes, it's very sad. And going back to the news story that Rudd has quit, it's all over the front page of the Sydney Morning Herald today, of course. And Peter Harcher, the political editor of the Sydney Morning Herald, writes, "It's a problem that for a year now, the opinion polls have been steadily conveying a simple and unmistakable message that the Australian people do not approve of Julia Gillard and will not elect her." He says the bile that has been spilling from the ranks of the Gillard government in the past few days has been all about Kevin. It was a miscalculation. Rudd turned the caucus spite to his advantage. He used it as the opportunity to openly break with Gillard and quit her cabinet. And a rather amusing cartoon. There's a very orange-haired...
Yes.
Julia Gillard.
She's looking lovely in that.
And the caption and the balloon coming out of her is saying, "Not supported him as foreign minister, I loved him being far away on the other side of the world."
Indeed. Well, obviously, we'll have to see how that develops. I'm sure we'll continue to hear headlines on that. So now it's time for the World Weather Report with Thomas Schaffernacker.
The weather, in association with Kiwoni Travel.
It's starting to feel like spring in Western Europe. By tomorrow, temperatures in the UK and Western France will reach 15 to 17 degrees, more like April. However, with that comes cloud and also a bit of rain. Further south in Europe, in Portugal and Spain, warm and sunny, and that goes for most of the Mediterranean. Here's Thursday's City Outlook. In London, a very mild 16 degrees, breezy with some sunshine. Frankfurt, 12 Celsius, partly cloudy. In Budapest, it's 7. Also some clouds, and in Athens, 14 degrees with sunshine. How about North America? In the eastern half of the US and Canada, the next 2 days will be often cloudy with some rain in many of the major cities. Relatively mild for February 2. However, come Friday, it'll turn colder in Chicago and New England. Some snow perhaps on the way too. In the meantime, here's Thursday's City Outlook. In Chicago, 6 degrees, some rain. New York City, 13 degrees, also light rain. Houston, 26 degrees, partly cloudy here, and in Los Angeles, 21 degrees and sunny. And quick look at other world centres as well. If you're off to or already in Sydney, some great weather the next few days, sunny skies and just a few showers, highs up to 27 degrees at the harbour. In Singapore, well, typical tropical weather, PM thunder showers and 31 degrees. In Shanghai, it's chilly, often cloudy, around 7 Celsius, and Tokyo, also cloudy with a rain chance and 8 degrees here. That's all. I'm meteorologist Thomas Schaffernacker here on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 ei oo kosa.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The proper Jalava.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House, live from Studio One with me, Emma Barnett. Now, online transactions company PayPal has announced its plans to create 1,000 new jobs in Ireland. The statement underlines the importance Ireland attaches to its vision of becoming the Silicon Valley of Europe. Yesterday's news was the first substantial jobs announcement since the economic downturn badly hit Ireland. The latest unemployment figures show that 14.2% of Ireland's population is without a job. But while PayPal's news is a boost on paper, will the jobs go to those who need them the most? Joining me on the line is Jonathan Horton, Professor of Economics at Suffolk University in Boston and writer for the Irish Times. Hi, Jonathan.
Oh, hello.
Thanks for joining me. Why is this creation, then, announced by PayPal of jobs so important to Ireland?
Well, I think there are two bits of it. One is, of course, it's a psychological boost. This is a really big job announcement. There have been others recently. HP announced 280 jobs in the near future, MasterCard another 130, but 1,000 jobs, I mean, for an economy like Ireland, that's a real number. And then the second thing, of course, the jobs themselves, when they materialize, will be more than welcome with 14.2% unemployment. That's equivalent to bringing it down from 14.2 to 14.1.
Yes.
May not seem like a lot, but it does matter.
But will those jobs go to the people who are not in work already? That's the key question, isn't it? Or is it going to go to people who've already got jobs that fancy working at PayPal?
Well, the centre will be in Dundalk, and Dundalk has a relatively high rate of unemployment. It's hard to know how many will be drawn away from other jobs and how many will be brand new jobs. But these are not the very sort of top of the heap research jobs where you really are pulling people away from employment elsewhere. These are middle of the line jobs, as I understand it, where you need a good education, you need good English, you need to work hard, but that's exactly the pool of people who lost work in large numbers during the recession and who I think will be pulled into this. It will not create a lot of construction jobs. That's the other sector that's hurt badly. But yes, I would say most of these jobs will be drawn from people who would either not have jobs or are doing something below what they're trained for.
Well, let's hope so for those people's sake. But let's go back to this idea of European Silicon Valley, if you like. How realistic is that vision of itself for Ireland?
Well, it's a funny mixture. It's not so much just Silicon Valley. There are really, I think, three different groups here. One is financial services. And PayPal is not so much Silicon Valley as it is financial services. And one of the things Ireland did during the recession and was very heavily criticized for was bailing out its own financial sector rather than forcing them to take a bigger hit. But maybe that's exactly what now makes the country attractive to a company like PayPal, which is, after all, a registered bank in Luxembourg and has, I think, pretensions not just to be a way that you can pay your bills, but also possibly to move into true banking at some future point.
Why do you think PayPal picked Ireland then? I mean, you've touched upon a potential reason with the bailout of the banks, but do you think there are any other contributing factors?
Well, the official line, of course, would be well-educated, hard-working population. I think that...
Let's dig a little bit deeper on that then.
Yes, exactly. I think that there are a couple of other things that probably matter. One is it's basically English-speaking, and I think that increases the comfort level with PayPal's owners. It's an American company. It's now owned by eBay. Its biggest center here is in Omaha, and... So that makes communication a lot easier, and it makes the comfort level higher when American managers and investors are looking to establish a place overseas. And I think there is a history of Ireland servicing the European market fairly successfully. And so there are other centers like Google that have used Ireland as a platform, and their success suggests that it can be done from Ireland.
But obviously, I mean, you instantly hear about the likes of Twitter and then now PayPal, for instance, being in Ireland, and you think of the financial benefits.
Right. I mean, the financial benefits will be real, but these are businesses and jobs like other sort of businesses and jobs. They're also fragile. If you can move 1,000 jobs into a country this easily, you can move them out that easily too. So it's a delicate balance. You want the jobs, you want the companies, but it wouldn't take that much to scare them away. And during a lot of Ireland's boom years in the latter period, since about 2002, 2003, 2004, Ireland has simply become too expensive to attract much foreign investment. And to some extent, the real significance here is that Ireland has presumably become cheap enough again for investors to find it to be an interesting place to invest.
And just to get a bit of an idea of the state of the economy across Ireland at the moment then, are there any green shoots of recovery?
Well, the central bank, maybe it has a bias towards optimism, I don't know, does forecast economic GDP growth of 1.8% for 2012. That would be positive. The disastrous year, of course, was 2009 when GDP fell by 7%. And then it sort of bottomed out. But bottoming out is not green shoots.
No, it's just sort of getting by, isn't it?
Exactly. I think there are, yes, retail sales in December were up 2% compared to November. And a lot of that was because of car buying. And if people are out there buying cars, one story is, of course, all the old ones are rusting. But the other story is that people are becoming confident and they're
spending some cash again. Indeed.
Exactly.
Well, finally then, Jonathan, are there any other major companies that you know of that are looking to open up in Ireland and create some more jobs?
Not that I know of. I know, for example, though, that Abbott Labs announced another 175 jobs. And you mentioned the sort of Silicon Valley story, but actually it's in pharmaceuticals that Ireland may be relatively attractive.
And Abbott Labs, sorry, is that a pharmaceutical? Excuse my ignorance. Pharmaceutical
absolutely,
lab.
Yes.
Okay.
Abbott Labs is pharmaceuticals. So that's a big sector.
That's a big sector as well.
And there's a certain amount of research activity, and those are particularly good jobs for the most part.
Okay, well, I'll be interested to chart that story some more and hopefully speak to you again. Thank you very much for joining me. That was Jonathan Horton, Professor of Economics at Suffolk University in Boston and a writer for the Irish Times. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
The March issue of Monocle marks a very special moment. It's our fifth birthday. In this celebratory issue, we take a close look at how Australia has transformed itself into a resources king and a diplomatic player. By Poland as a new aviation industry high flyer, and we meet a woman still doing very good business in Spain. And there's lots more.
In the design section, we visit a very traditional Swiss furniture manufacturer where old techniques are gathering new business. And we take a tour of Marcio Kogan's latest creation in Sao Paulo.
In the edit section, we head to Tokyo's Hiro District to find out what TV chef Kentaro Kobayashi would order for his last meal.
Plus, there's a 16-page review of Monocle's first 5 years, the perfect place to call home in Boston, and five big ideas to change the world. The March issue of Monocle is on newsstands now or available via subscription at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
With bureaus in Hong Kong, Tokyo, New York and Zurich, and over 25 correspondents around the world, Monocle has an experienced team of editors and journalists filing for us around the clock. From our bureau in Hong Kong, Liv Lewichnik covers Southeast Asia.
From Hong Kong, I cover China, Malaysia, Singapore, the Philippines and other Asian nations. And I also do stories in Australia from time to time. In Harbin, northeast China, I visited moon robot builders and Siberian tigers. And I popped over to Penang to check out the property market in Georgetown, a place that has the feel of 1960s Singapore to it. I love working from Hong Kong. It's a regional hub for commerce and finance that is taking leaps and bounds on the international art scene. It's got some of the best restaurants and shops around, and being one of the easiest places to start a business, it's a hotspot for startups. It's a city in fast forward, which is just the way we like it.
That was Monocle's Liv Lewichnik, our woman in Hong Kong.
From the inability of wealth to make us happier, to our catastrophic blindness to the credit crunch, Economists, a new book by mathematician David Orwell, claims to reveal 10 ways in which economics has let us all down and what we can do about it. It explains how the economy is a result of complex and unpredictable processes and how new ideas in mathematics, psychology and environmentalism are helping to reinvent economics. Joining me on the line is author David Orrell. Welcome, David.
Thank you.
So can you explain a couple of the main economists in layman's terms to us, please?
Yeah, I think the main sort of overall meta-myth, if you like, is this idea of the economy as being a kind of a stable, rational, efficient machine, which sort of optimizes everything, you know, if you just let it run free. I think one of the best illustrations of this, actually, you know, after writing the book, I thought one of the strangest things was the way that economic theory doesn't really have that much to say about something as basic as money. It turns out that the kind of economic models which are used, for example, by the Bank of England to kind of predict what's going to happen in the economy don't take into account financial institutions, and this is because from a sort of a theoretical point of view, money shouldn't be important, you know. But as we found from this crisis, which was led by a banking crisis, first of all, and it's a sort of ripple through the rest of the economy. So it's kind of this idea that a story of the economy as being very, very rational, efficient, stable, it sort of works automatically, it's just turned out to be completely wrong, and so we need to reinvent it.
So what inspired the book then?
Well, it's a topic that I've been interested in for a while. I mean, as you mentioned, I'm a mathematician by training, and I'd written an earlier book about prediction in different areas, such as weather forecasting, genetics, and then there's a chapter on economics. And this was a few years ago, and as I learned about the kinds of models which are used in economics, I mean, in the end, economics is kind of a mathematical model of human behavior, if you like. And so from a mathematical perspective, I was interested in the assumptions that it was making about how human beings behave, and I just thought they were very strange. And that sort of, you know, got me interested. And then after the sort of crash of 2007, 2008, which is still continuing, I thought, look, this is really the time to write a book about the subject, because partially because of all the things which I thought were wrong with the old theory, but also because all of a sudden we're getting lots of new ideas from other areas of applied math, but, you know, all kind of coming together at the same time. So now there seems to be a very good opportunity to really change things.
So for people who aren't necessarily as familiar with this topic as you are, you say there needs to be some kind of new structure or new theory put in place to replace the old theory of economics. What is that new theory, in your opinion?
Well, I think the core of the theory is really switching from this idea of the economy as a machine to seeing it more as kind of a complex organism, a little bit like a living thing in a way. Okay, so the sort of mathematics which you use for studying mechanistic things is very different from the kind of mathematics which has evolved more recently for studying living systems. And I'm thinking of things like network theory and complexity theory. So network theory, for an example, is something that's just been used in lots of different areas. For example, engineers use it to analyze something like the electricity network. It's also used in biology to, you know, your body is kind of a network of all sorts of interacting proteins and genes, which are sort of in constant communication with one another. And scientists have found that by analyzing these networks, you know, they can figure out that what portions of what processes are controlled by which players and how they're all interacting. So the thing is, this element is really missing from standard economic theory, which sort of sees everything as being very individualistic and everything as very separate. But I think, you know, the one definite lesson we've learned recently is how connectedness is so important in the economy, right? It's sort of like it's a little bit like the power of social networks that you're seeing in the Arab Spring Revolution, for example, where things can suddenly spread from one country to another. Well, it's exactly the same in the financial network, because you have a crisis in one area like Greece, you know, can propagate rapidly through the rest of the system and affect everybody else. So this is the kind of thing that something like network theory can actually help you get on top of. I mean, first of all, by measuring it, but then also coming up with ways of designing the network so it can be more stable.
And do other economists agree with these findings?
Yeah, they do, you know, because it's a bit funny with economics, because there's sort of this mainstream economics thing which has been going on for about 150 years. And in the background, there are all these so-called heterodox economists who talk about things like the importance of, for example, behavioral psychology, or the importance of environmental and ecological factors and this kind of thing. So I think it's what this book is doing is it's not so much, what it's trying to do is sort of bring together all of these different strands and show that together they really represent a plausible alternative to the current theory.
And I was interested to read in one of the blurbs about your book that it took until 2009 for a woman to win the Nobel Prize for Economics. Excuse me. Why do you think that was?
She's a political scientist. Well, yeah, that's interesting. I think the generally in science there is a bit of a gender issue, you know, because it's the same in other areas. But economics actually is really kind of an extreme case, and it's affected a number of things, and I think it's affected the theory quite a lot, you know, because if you look at the idea of rational economic man, which is, you know, everyone knows it's kind of a cliche, and everyone knows it's not exactly like that, but it's still sort of the picture, the first thing, you know, that you might learn in university about economics, and this idea is really the idea that everyone is individual, they're rational, they don't communicate with other people, they just do what they want to maximize their own utility. And this is actually a very stereotypical picture of masculine behavior. And if you look at sort of the way the theory goes, you can sort of see that it's consistently, it emphasizes these masculine qualities. It's mostly been developed by men. I mean, nearly totally.
So maybe we need a little bit of a female touch and we won't get into such a mess next time. That's what I'll conclude from this. So thank you very much for joining me. We were talking about the book Economists, which you can now buy, and that was David Orrell, the author. You're listening to Midori House. Now it's time for some music, and this is Be My Baby by Vanessa Paradis. That was Be My Baby by Vanessa Paradis. You're listening to Midori House, live on Monocle 24.
LDNTYO NYC MT4.
In the next half an hour on Midori House, we'll be joined by Monocle photo director Poppy Shibamoto, creative director Richard Spencer Powell, and James Malore, the art director, to discuss the photography and illustrations in Monocle magazine. But first, here's Nick Kelly with the news headlines.
A packed commuter train ploughed into the buffers at a Buenos Aires station during this morning's rush hour, killing 49 people and injuring more than 600 in Argentina's worst rail accident in more than 30 years. The Afghan president, Hamid Karzai, has appealed for calm after officials said at least six people were shot dead and dozens wounded in protests over the burning of copies of the Quran at NATO's main base in the country. The presidents of Russia and Iran have said that the crisis in Syria must be resolved peacefully without foreign intervention. President Assad's forces rained rockets and bombs down on opposition-held neighbourhoods of Homs today, reducing buildings to rubble and killing more than 80 people, including two Western journalists. The verdict in the trial of the former Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak, charged with ordering the killing of protesters in the uprising that swept him from power, will be delivered on June the 2nd. Ethiopian and Somali troops captured a key Islamist militant stronghold in Somalia today as the rebels left their positions. The United Nations nuclear watchdog has said that it had failed to reach an agreement with Iran during 2 days of talks over disputed nuclear activities. And Yemen began a new era without Ali Abdullah Saleh today after an uncontested election that gave his deputy a mandate to launch reforms in a country facing an economy in meltdown, a tenacious al-Qaeda wing, and rebellions in the north and south. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24 with me, Emma Barnett. Every day this week, we'll be looking into the people who create Monocle's magazine, films and radio. Today, joining me in the studio is Monocle's creative director, Richard Spencer Powell, photo director, Poppy Shibamoto, and art director, James Malore, to discuss the thinking behind the magazine's artwork, what they look for in a photographer, and how the design has evolved. Welcome. So I thought we'd start off by discussing, and I'll open it out to all three of you, how did you come up with Monocle's distinctive design and sort of photographic style?
Well, if I can start and just sort of talk perhaps about the design to begin with. Obviously, we're at the five-year mark, but I think it probably started in earnest about 6 years ago. And it started really in conversation between Tyler and myself. We had a publishing history. We worked together at Wallpaper. And we'd done 4 years of sort of branding work with Wink. And we'd looked at a lot of custom publishing, and we were always looking at magazines and discussing what things we liked and what we didn't like. We kind of drew up a checklist of things we didn't like. And from a sort of photographic point of view, we sort of spotted there was a trend that we felt that photographers and more so stylists were, I mean, this is fashion photography, they were kind of just building their own portfolios, and the imagery, it just wasn't quite relevant to anyone. And so we really didn't want to do that. And the content of the magazine, of course, was reportage because it was news. So we tried to kind of let that flow through every section of the magazine. So even when it came down to fashion photography, we had this real reportage style that we set from the outset. We tried to shoot film. We tried to send photographers to, you know, far-flung places, as well as invest in local talent, and just really try and get some craft back in where we felt perhaps digital photography had started to, it started to show. And when you look back at older issues of things, there was a quality that suddenly seemed to be missing. So that was kind of that, I suppose, the initial impetus of kind of how we set some of the broad strokes.
Okay, and Poppy, coming to you, I mean, how do you select the photographers that you send out to cover different events?
We have our certain standards as well, and then also have a good old classic photographer who's been contributing for 5 years or even before for Rich. And both worked, and then new photographers, in terms of new photographers, we try to choose someone who's honest and bright. We always want to tell a positive story rather than looking at the dark side of negative side of things. So we try to look for bright and photographer who can deliver something more than something what we can see as well, something that they can see in their view, something epic, something, you know, the reader want to see. Yeah.
Okay. And coming to you, James, how did you come up and choose the illustration style of the magazine?
Well, the illustration style has kind of evolved over the 50 issues. We try to refresh our roster, but we still keep a staple of illustrators, mainly Japanese illustrators. But I guess we choose the illustrators because we need like a positive style. We like bright, impactful illustrations, and we like, there needs to be some charm in there too. There always needs to be charm in the illustration. The reader needs to see it straight away and get the humour.
And I want
from
to
the story.
Read it.
Yeah. I think because also there's a lot of heavy, long bits of journalism at the start of the magazine. We do cover affairs and business. So often the illustration can just lend a light touch, a little bit of, you know,
light relief.
A little bit of wit where you need it here and there.
Wit and light relief. I mean, coming to you, Rich, obviously you've been working on this the whole way through, even, as you say, before the 5 years. How long did it take for you to sort of get exactly what you were looking for? How long in development was the style and the feel and the image? And was there a particular moment where you thought, right, we've nailed it?
It was quite quick. But again, I think it's because it was sort of, we were thinking about it for such a long time and talking about it. And like I say, we had this sort of checklist of things we didn't want to do. So it narrowed down a lot of things. We knew we wanted something bookish. We had an idea about our trim size. We kind of debated whether to have a white cover or black cover. We went with black in the end, which I'm very glad about. But in terms of actual design time, I think we probably cracked it over a weekend. We got, I think, probably 70% of the magazine done. And that then became the initial sales tool. And when you look at that sales tool on the first issue, it is quite close. I think then, once after launch, I think after sort of five issues, issue five is a bit of a turning point for us. We tweaked the design there for the first time. The cover changed. And then from then on, it's been a very sort of slow, gradual change. I mean, if you look at issue 50 and issue one, they might seem quite far apart. But we try to not reinvent because with the design, the intention is that it's designed to last. It's not faddish. It's not fashionable. It's not flash. It should be, you know, in 100 years, it should still be the same typeface, the same word mark, and the same small logo. So, yeah, it was quick, but it's I think there's reason.
I don't know which of you wants to do this, but I mean, in terms of walking me through the paper choices for Monocle and why that's a critical choice for the particular issue, you know, in this particular type of magazine, what's the thinking behind that? I'll go to you, Rich.
Well, it's a bit whimsical. The thinking is we just like paper. I mean, essentially that's it. We wanted an uncoated paper because we wanted it to feel bulky and bookish, and we just like uncoated papers. We chose a gloss at the back because we wanted to celebrate photography, and that just holds ink better. You'll get a better reproduction. But in terms of the paper chopping and changing, it is purely we just like to celebrate print and all the things you can do in print and paper and trim sizes and colours, and we try and put as many specials and things in as we can. And that, you know, that direction comes right from the top. Tyler's, I mean, over the 5 years, I must have had 50 separate paper samples and tear sheets and things put on my desk on that particular subject.
So you know a lot about paper now.
Yeah, I think so.
Poppy, let me come to you. When you're picking photos and you're putting the magazine together, do you have a certain type of person in mind or a certain audience member when you're trying to create that feel? And then maybe I can extend the same question to you, James.
I'm not sure. I would always think about, you know, like a reader would have been, you know, more intelligent than me. So, like, try not to choose something silly, but also...
sell yourself short. Come on.
I always think, you know, like, the things we show in Monaco is so well-travelled, the report from everywhere. So, if I was a person who had never been to that place, what do I want to see? Do I get a sense of a place? The people who live there, are they happy? Are they not happy? You know, the sort of thing. So I'm trying to be almost outsider thinking what reader want to see to get the sense of the place or to get the sense of a company we are reporting or person we photograph as a portrait.
And James, do you have anyone in mind or a particular type of audience member?
I don't know how they look exactly, but I guess when we're choosing illustration, we don't want them to be bored, I guess.
Yeah,
that's the main key thing. That's the key thing. We keep on revolving illustrators, and we keep on trying to find new talent. And we try to push the illustrators in a way that if we've seen their portfolio and certain things they can do, we try and evolve their style along as they work with us through however many issues. Their style evolves as they work with us.
I think what you're saying about the illustration is really interesting, keeping it light, keeping it witty with that mixture of, you know, very serious reporting that you do get in Monocle. But I think personally, when you see Monocle, you know, first of all, it looks like a magazine you wouldn't dare steal from anywhere because it's like a proper coffee table type magazine book. But also, it's quite it's quite daunting. Okay, I'm going to challenge myself by opening this magazine and trying to digest the whole world in one issue. I mean, was that the aim?
I think one of the early aims was to make a magazine that truly is a monthly magazine. I think if you pick up a lot of magazines, you can just skip through so quickly. It's, you know, the front cover will probably feature a celebrity because they've got a film coming out. You'd have seen the trailer to that film. You may have even seen that film. There'll be three music reviews. You'll know what those songs are. And you can just skip so quickly. You can digest a copy of, let's just say, a UK men's magazine in like 15 minutes. And I think what we wanted was, yeah, okay, there's, you know, a 2,000-word essay there that maybe you don't want to read today, but you'll set it aside and read it at the weekend. But that we make something that's long enough, that's dense enough to last a month. And we work quite hard on getting the pace correct and the density correct, so that it kind of, you know, you get little pockets that are a bit lighter. And again, that's how the artwork, you know, helps the reader through. But really, yeah, we want something to last you the month and to last you the year for a subscriber.
I think it'll last a long time, actually, each issue, in terms of the durability of it, the paper. All comes back to the paper. Poppy, have you got any particular favourite photos or favourite issues or favourite images that you want to refer to?
Is it from, should I choose from issue 21 to 30?
Well, that's what we're focusing on this good. Midori House.
One I really like is a train fashion story we did in issue 29, and we've been working with a Japanese fashion team from first issue, and this was quite a tricky trip, and we shot on return journeys one way and the other way back, and did women's on the way and came back with menswear shoe, and it was difficult to get, you know, sort of access and everything, but it looks really nice. And because I'm from Japan as well, it just portrayed the nice wintry light, and I think that's really nice.
Okay, well, I think we'll go back through some more of those issues in more detail very shortly. Rich and Poppy are going to be staying with us in the studio to look through issues 21 to 30 of Monocle, so do stay with us, and thank you very much, James.
Thank you.
For the latest Monocle news, previews on upcoming films, glimpses of the new issue, and the inside scoop of all of our retail ventures and new products, you need to do one simple thing. Subscribe to the free Monocle Bulletin. Sign up now at monocle.com.
Every Monday, Monocle's culture editor, Robert Bound, casts a keen eye across the week's cultural events, taking in cinema, art, music, media, literature, and some of the world's more exclusive events. That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday on Monocle 24 at 1900 London time, and available on our Timeshift player and on iTunes.
Now, before we look through past issues of the magazine, we're going to hear some music. This is Up in Flames by Lucky Soul. That was Up in Flames by Lucky Soul. It's 1847 in London. Now, every day on Midori House, we'll be picking our favourite articles from past copies of Monocle this week. And today we have issues 21 to 30, so that's the end of 2008 going into 2009. We still have Poppy and Rich in the studio here with me. And joining us is Monocle's editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
So, interesting time, wasn't it, with the markets, end of 2008, beginning of 2009?
It was, because we launched at the start of 2007, so everything felt pretty good, and ad budgets were quite healthy. But, then, of course, by the back of 2008 and going into 2009, I mean, it was a really different place, I mean, for print media in particular. So not just, the forces of the market, but I think that was really the time, and you'd probably have an opinion on it as well, but just, the big sort of digitalization question mark over media and how relevant print was, et cetera. So it was a really challenging time. Oddly, though, I think because, Rich before the break in the song was talking about sort of that bookishness and everything we were doing, we largely sailed through it just fine.
On a nice wadge of paper.
Exactly.
Okay, so Tyler, do you want to start with a few of your favourite picks then?
One of the covers which really stands out for me, this is the March 09 issue. And this is issue number 21. And it was just, we started, I think we've always sort of loved outposts in the world. So we went down to the Falklands, and it was just but this is a Gaku cover, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it's just this wonderful sort of the hand of God. If you could if you could re-engineer the Falklands, what would it look like? And I know it was very powerful. It reminded me of maybe something, you might have seen, in old copies of Vanity Fair, but I'm talking sort of Vanity Fair of the 1930s or 1940s. I love the cover on it. But when I look through the issue as well, there are a couple of really, star moments. One of the real standout stories for me, though, is, oddly, it's a radio piece. And when we sent our Robert Bound to KCRW in Los Angeles. Poppy, I'm not sure if we've ever used this guy Randy Barras before or ever.
We have.
I just think these pictures are just amazing. And maybe that was actually the start of the audio journey as well. I think when we saw, beautiful sort of mic stands, and there's a real richness to it. The other thing that stands out as well, we did in our National Icon series, we had our Beirut correspondent, Carol Corm. She profiled her granny. Not that we're nepotistic here, ever. Her grandmother is also profiled in Section A, and she's just an absolute star of a woman as well. Yeah, those are my picks. Those are my picks. Any of that issue? Just going back to May Arida, and it's just these pictures as well. She was also the water ski champion of Lebanon as well. But she still
she looks great.
Yeah, she's fabulous.
Okay, wow. So Poppy, you started by telling me a few of your favourites. Have you got another one that you want
I've
to share?
I've got a few.
Okay.
On the same issue 21, we also had exactly the same illustrator as the cover, did this A&A advertorial, which was really nice. It's a fresh idea. He came up with the idea and just did it. And it just gave illustrator quite a big freeway. And I think that turned out really well.
I'm trying to find it.
I think that's 21.
It is issue 21.
Yeah.
It was
folded.
It's funny to actually talk about something which is not editorial. This is an advertisement for all intents and purposes. But it was so well integrated. But I love that the illustrator, and he's a monk from Kyoto, and he, you do. Yeah, exactly. And then he just went to the trouble of illustrating every single person in the window of this 777.
Exactly.
And every single person's like different and kind of doing their own thing. And you always have to be very careful when he sends illustrations because, there's always people having sex somewhere.
Yeah.
There's always a little
toilet.
Or using a toilet or something like that, yeah.
Yeah, he's got a dark side. Yes. A spiritual side.
Absolutely.
Nice. Rich, are there any standout moments for you that you particularly like to draw upon?
Yeah, plenty. I'm just going to jump a little bit ahead and go to issue 28, and I'm going to pick the cover because I think it's one of my favourite covers we've ever done. It's the cover story.
Hold up so I can see it.
I'm trying to see.
The cover line is all about small business, and I think this was my. It's a supplement. It's a standalone supplement that comes within the magazine. The cover image is of a handsome Swede named Johan, and I'm quite proud of the cover graphics. It's this little flow diagram. Commercially, this one did very well, but that's not why I'm picking it. But I think there's just a real warmth to it, and the supplement I think delivered in spades. Actually, it's a great supplement. The content is brilliant. It's all about small business, and when I was designing that, although I'm extremely happy in my job, it was one of those things where I was laying the pages out and thinking, I wonder if I could set up a little carpentry studio in Hamburg.
Don't think about it, Rich.
With a coffee shop on the side kind of thing. But it's just a lovely bit of print.
And I think editorially what was really interesting about that is, we wanted to do the small business issue because we were hearing from our readers. They were saying, I love the magazine, but I was laid off from my job at a major bank, etc. And we started having the discussion in, I guess probably, in spring, knowing at the back part of the year, there were going to be a lot of people who were let go from major financial institutions. So why don't we let them dream a little? And I mean, this wasn't a public service exercise. We'd worked with a sponsor on the project as well. But we thought this is actually a really interesting turning point. Not just for where the markets ended up, but for talented people all over the world. That suddenly you get this payoff, and you really have a chance to dream a little bit. And what was wonderful in the following months, how we, there's just correspondence from all over the world. People just said, I picked that up. And in fact, I looked at it. I didn't pick it up again until Christmas time. And then I said to my partner over the holidays, maybe I should go and start that gallery. Why don't we just go and buy that vineyard? And it was great. And so we have this dialogue with these people who actually looked at that small business guide. And I think they really, they went for a bit of an about face in their life.
How important is it to try and, because obviously you're a monthly and you don't want to, we've just been discussing, you don't want to be that sort of vacuous monthly magazine that you can skim through. How important is it, and how do you gauge a trend amongst your readers? Because they are diverse, they live all the way around the world, and a global trend is quite difficult. And with that, I can really see that as a trend. But, what's the thinking that goes into that?
I think it's twofold. I mean, one, I think we just have to have the confidence on the floor, and when I say the floor upstairs, I mean the editorial floor, that knowing that we're out there enough, and whether Jonathan, as our business editor, has gone off in Switzerland and spoken to someone, or has experienced a business, and then I've been in Osaka talking to someone, and oftentimes it's there's just a feeling, there's a mood in the room. It doesn't necessarily come out of a story meeting, oddly, because we're not a very meeting intensive company. It's quite, now that we're doing audio, of course we have we have twice daily meetings, but normally there's just, I think there's a real intimate understanding within the business of, and almost intuitive, you would say, of where the world is going and how things are moving. So it's a little bit by osmosis. And then I think we have a real active dialogue with our readers, though. And so going back to how do you spot trends, I think because all of our emails are on the masthead, and I think we're always sort of talking about the correspondence that we get, there's a certain intimacy. And I think because of that intimacy, maybe people are a little bit more direct in their message. And I think that's how we're also able to pick up currents in the world.
In terms of, you know, picking up those currents and feeding in what your readers want, though, is there sometimes, though, where you hear what they want and you think you know better?
Not necessarily. Well, it's normally not, I'm looking for this, you know, in the magazine. It's normally not editorial requests. I think people often have more service requests, I would say, and whether that is if they want their magazine delivered in another package. It's normally things surrounding it. It's not, and if it is editorial, they're more tips, which is great. So someone's saying, look, I was just in Kiev, and I think that this is something that you need to try. Or by the way, yeah, you may not be big fans of this airline, but when you fly this route, they've put this aircraft or there's this service on it. You know, that's something which is really good for Santiago's pages. So that, it's more tip based as opposed to, I'm missing something. I mean, one thing we do get a lot, and I never pass these emails on to Rich, is that people are often asking for more sport. Sorry, Rich.
Yeah, no, it's true. I think also lots of our readers, they want to contribute, so they'll pitch ideas.
Okay.
And, they're kind of in the outer circle, as it were, and their ideas can just be a little bit off. And that's not really a complaint. It's just, why don't you do this?
I've
seen this thing. And
we all
just
get suggestions, don't we? And we sort of go, okay. But, go back to 2008, 2009, these particular issues. How did you avoid repetition in terms of the image and feel of the magazine, as there was just one big story and you are very business focused and it was the crash? How did you keep it fresh each month?
It's a great question because, one, we haven't really delved into this, and we don't have a Monocle brand book, per se, which talks about the editorial values. I think everyone sort of knows what we stand for, but there is an optimism to the brand, and I think that's really, it's one of the reasons why we continue to grow during that period. We didn't even sort of think about it at the time, but no matter what it was, we were always being very solution driven. I think no matter what covers you were looking at here, if it was the July August issue, where to live and work, the most livable cities in the world, the Falkland story was about, getting away from it all, opportunities in the South Atlantic. So, yeah, and it wasn't almost deliberate. We didn't sort of sit down, but we just said, everyone else was doing covers with a black arrow dropping off, the bottom right hand of the page.
Exactly. And then while we'd start doing from issue 21, things like why it works, and then dissect it a company and see how things work better. And it's developed into does it work now? But
exactly.
We always look at the positive side, how we can solve a problem.
Yeah. There's a happy optimism.
Well, good. I'm happy there's some optimism because it was all doom and gloom in that era. Well, that was Monocle's Tyler Brune, Poppy Shibamoto and Richard Spencer Powell. Thank you very much, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Midori House.
This is Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Essa Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And a Monocle 24 target, yeah.
Monocle 24,
this is Monocle 24.
Tämä on Monocle 24. The
Bropa Jalavet. Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
We're out of time for this Wednesday edition of Midori House. Today's show was produced by Dawn Trump, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager was Andrew Carter. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow, where we'll be looking back over the Monocle film archive. The Monocle Daily will be back at 2200 London time, where the team will be hosting a roundtable discussion to talk about the role of foreign journalists in Syria. But next on Monocle 24 is The Entrepreneurs with Jonathan Openshaw, so tune in and stay tuned in for that. I've been Emma Barnett, and this has been Midori House. Goodbye.